Minnesota House Committee on Public Safety and Criminal Justice Reform for the 92nd State Legislative Session will come to order. The clerk will take the roll.
Chair Mariani.
Present.
Chair Mariani, present. Vice Chair Frazier.
Present.
Vice Chair Frazier, present. Lee Johnson.
Present.
Lee Johnson, present. Rep. Edelson.
Present.
Rep. Edelson, present. Rep. Feist.
Present.
Rep. Feist, present. Rep. Grossel.
Present.
Rep. Grossel, present. Rep. Hollins.
Present.
Rep. Hollins, present. Rep. Hewitt.
Present.
Rep. Hewitt, present. Rep. Cleavorn.
Cleavorn, present.
Rep. Cleavorn, present. Rep. Long.
Present.
Rep. Long, present. Rep. Lucero.
Always an honor.
Rep. Lucero, present. Rep. Mueller.
Mueller, present.
Rep. Mueller, present. Rep. Novotny.
Novotny, present.
Rep. Novotny, present. Rep. O'Neill.
O'Neill, present.
Rep. O'Neill, present. Rep. Pinto.
Present.
Rep. Pinto, present. Rep. Poston.
Present.
Rep. Poston, present. Rep. Raleigh.
Raleigh, present.
Rep. Raleigh, present. Rep. Vang.
Present.
Rep. Vang, present. Rep. Shung.
Present.
Rep. Shung, present. And that concludes roll call.
Very well. There is a quorum. Members, this hearing is being conducted under Minnesota House Rule 10.01, allowing for hearings to be held via use of distance voting, remote electronic voting, or voting by other means to protect the health and safety of the public, staff, and members. The hearing is live streamed on our House website and can be accessed via the committee page. Those wishing to offer public testimony can contact via email the committee administrator, Mr. Jamal Lundy, 24 hours prior to a hearing. The email address is also available on our committee page. Members, as typical, our first order of business is to adopt our minutes from our last meeting. And Vice Chair Frazier, if you would please offer an amendment to do that, or rather a motion to do that.
So moved, Chair.
Very well. Discussion, members. Let me pull up my participants' hand list. Okay, real good. Lee Johnson, we're okay with a voice vote, right?
That would be fine.
Very well, thank you. All in favor of adoption of the minutes of March 11th, please say aye.
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 Opposed, same sign. Motion prevails, and the minutes of March 11th are adopted. Members, today is Department of Public Safety Policy Day. We have three bills before us. We have two bills that the chair is authoring. The first bill is on our private detective board. Our second bill is the big, department's policy bill. And then we have a bill from Representative Hewitt on emergency communication services stemming from the task force report, task force that we authorized last year. So with that, members, I'm going to move first to House File 3955. The chair moves that to refer House File 3955 to the General Register. The motion is before us, and members, we don't spend a whole lot of time in this committee on the board of private detectives. We probably should spend a lot more time. Time is precious to us, but it's a really important board. It does really important work and arguably deserves much more attention as a result of the broad importance of their work. Public safety is something that constantly shifts and changes as our society shifts and changes, and technology, social media, increase citizen participation in their First Amendment rights, challenging issues for our society, all of those come together and are putting some important demands on this sector. There is, as a result, a real drive for greater professionalism from both within the sector and from outside the sector. And along with that, a greater drive for accountability, a greater drive for transparency, and a greater drive for collaborative work with our public sector side of public safety. We're fortunate we've got a board that responsibly pays attention to that. So this bill before us is a recommendation from that board itself relative to training issues and certification recognition and transportability of that certification and training. So with us today, we have the Executive Director of the Minnesota Board of Private Detective and Protective Agent Services, Hugo McPhee. And so I'll ask Mr. McPhee to come forward, introduce himself for the record, and tell us about this bill and tell us about the board.
Chair Mariani, Vice Chair Frazier, thank you very much, and committee members, for the opportunity to present and talk about the Private Detective Board and Protective Service Agents. The legislation you have in front of you is fairly straightforward and has broad and wide-ranging support from members of the industry and the board itself, which is made up of members of the industry as well as public members appointed. The current legislation basically requires new hires coming into the industry to have what's called pre-assignment training conducted within their first 21 days of employment, but it stands moot on how long that certification lasts, what if you've left employment and are seeking to get back into the industry. And so there is some confusion there and some handcuffing, if you will, for staff and the board to make proper interpretation to allow greater access for people to join the private security or private investigative industry. The proposed legislation essentially has three bullet points. One, it seeks to recognize pre-assignment training if it has occurred within the last 3 years as being acceptable for the purposes of this statute. Specifically, that's a benefit to people trying to crack the industry or people leaving jobs within the industry and have a gap in employment. The advantage of having the pre-assignment training be credited or active for up to 3 years is it prevents a new company or it allows a new company to hire people who've had that training without sending them to additional training, which they've just recently had, but through a technicality could not apply. Pre-assignment training can cost as much as $400, so it's clearly a benefit to employers and certainly a benefit to people trying to get into the industry so they don't have to have that cost potentially pass on to them. A second bullet point from this proposed legislation is that the certificate of pre-assignment training completion belongs to the student who, regardless of who paid for the course. So if you are a citizen who takes the pre-assignment training and now seek to get employment, that certificate belongs to you, even if you were working for a different employer. At the time, that employer needs to make that copy available to you, which comprises the third bullet point. So some very helpful changes to the industry to allow more people access and more portability within the industry.
Very well. Thank you, Director McPhee. Why don't we open this up for questions and comments? And first, I see we have Representative Poston.
Thank you, Chair Mariani. My question is for Mr. McPhee. We don't, like the chair said, we don't talk about this area an awful lot in our meetings. And I have to say, I need a little bit of education. What is the difference between a private detective and a protective agent, number one, and how many of each of those do we have in the state?
Thank you, sir, for the question. A private detective would be akin to a private investigator doing private investigative work, employee-type relations or background checks, those sorts of things. A protective agent, think more along the lines of a security officer, statute 326-338 actually further outlines those details and responsibilities, but high-level view, 30,000-foot level, think of the protective agents as the security officers, et cetera. We have about 400 licenses in the state, roughly broken down approximately equally. We have 166 protective agent licenses as of December 31st, and we have 190 private detective licenses. So it's broken down approximately 55-45%, and that constitutes approximately 13,000 people working under those various licenses in the state.
Thank you, sir. That's very helpful. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Representative Poston. Others? Lee Johnson.
Chair Mariani, members. Mr. McPhee, I was just wondering, could you explain to the committee the number of hours required of training and what type of training these individuals have to have?
Yes. So pre-assignment training consists of 12 hours of orientation training by statute, and specifically it covers things such as a security overview, legal authority, liability issues, communications, ethics, incident assessment and awareness. And additionally, for private detectives, it also includes a private detective role and function, legal authority, communications, rights of privacy, ethics, et cetera. Those are delineated Minnesota rules and are required by statute. In addition to the 12 hours of pre-assignment training, if an individual is armed, there's additional rules that apply for required training. And then after that first year of employment, there's an additional 6 hours of continuing ed credits every year that need to be taken. This particular legislation addresses the pre-assignment requirement.
Lee Johnson.
Chair Mariani and Mr. McPhee, thank you for that information. I trust that whatever number of hours is, if they're carrying a firearm, it goes into a lot more, goes into many hours of use of force, use of deadly force requirements, less legal options, which should be minimum 20 hours to do that. But I'm concerned with just 6 hours for 18 hours for a three-year license cycle. That's a little short, especially if they're carrying a firearm and the possibility of using deadly force. It's something that we may need to look into in these situations. And by your what you explained with the licenses, it sounds more like it's the agency that's licensed and not the individual, but the agency is required to provide this training to those individuals. And I believe it's a good thing that the training does go with the individual and not stay with the agency. But I think we need to look at a little, especially with some of the things going on, especially in Minneapolis and St. Paul, where crime has skyrocketed and businesses are actually hiring private security and private detective agencies to provide the security. That we may need to look into a more extensive training for these individuals because they're going to be involved in more and more serious encounters. So thank you for the information.
Yeah, thank you, Lee Johnson. And it does seem like, perhaps an ongoing conversation with committee members and the committee and the board relative to, those important issues that you raised. You know, the whole reality of when it comes to private agent, that you've got the agency license, just for us to be aware and understand the perhaps the pros and the cons of that. I think that this movement toward the portability of the certification, I think, really does help to make sure that each individual is, in fact, being paid attention to relative to the standards that the board, wishes it to have. I suspect, Director McPhee, that the 6 hours on the armed, that's by rules that the board itself establishes. Am I correct?
That is correct, Chair.
Right. So that could be an ongoing conversation with us as well. And I would note, members, that I know Lee Johnson singled out the two core cities, and that's not entirely wrong. However, The importance of this sector is felt, I would argue, across the state. We certainly have seen in the last few years, increased activity around First Amendment exercises related to a number of environmental issues, infrastructure issues across the state. And so you'll see a presence, of this private sector engaged there. And so it's critically important that we're paying attention to this issue, I would argue, not just in one part of the state, but actually across the state itself. Any other questions or comments? All right, very well. Director McPhee, I do appreciate your presence today. You and I had a scheduled meeting this morning, and I apologize to you in public that I was not able to make that. But I understand that you and our staff had a very fruitful meeting. I do think it's not the bill before us, but I would hope and encourage the board to come forward with smart and, in my opinion, necessary further investments and resources, from the state so that you can function as powerfully as we expect you to. You're a really small outfit, and I certainly don't want you to become a huge or large one, but I do think you should, I think the board should be effective. And for that, there is a critical, in my opinion, need of personnel and other resources. And hopefully we'll have that conversation a little later as we mark up our omnibus bill. But I'm just publicly encouraging you to objectively tell us, what's needed. Okay, members, with that, the chair, let me back up here. All right, with that, the chair renews his motion that House File 3955 be referred to the General Register, and the clerk will take the roll.
Chair Mariani.
Aye.
Chair Mariani, aye. Vice Chair Frazier.
Aye.
Vice Chair Frazier, aye. Lee Johnson.
Aye.
Lee Johnson, aye. Rep. Edelson.
Aye.
Rep. Edelson, aye. Rep. Feist.
Aye.
Rep. Feist, aye. Rep. Grossel. Rep. Grossel. Rep. Hollins.
Aye.
Rep. Hollins, aye. Rep. Hewitt.
Aye.
Rep. Hewitt, aye. Rep. Cleavorn.
Cleavorn, aye.
Rep. Cleavorn, aye. Rep. Long.
Aye.
Rep. Long, aye. Rep. Lucero.
Yes.
Rep. Lucero, aye. Rep. Mueller.
Mueller votes yes.
Rep. Mueller, aye. Rep. Novotny.
Novotny, aye.
Rep. Novotny, aye. Rep. O'Neill.
O'Neill, aye.
Rep. O'Neill, aye. Rep. Pinto.
Aye.
Rep. Pinto, aye. Rep. Poston.
Aye.
Rep. Poston, aye. Rep. Raleigh.
Raleigh, aye.
Rep. Raleigh, aye. Rep. Vang.
Aye.
Rep. Vang, aye. Rep. Shung.
Aye.
Rep. Shung, aye.
Grossel, aye.
Grossel, aye. Thank you. With 19 ayes and 0 nays, that concludes roll call.
Very well. With 19 ayes and 0 nays, the motion prevails, and House File 3955 is referred to the General Register. Thank you, members. Thank you, Director McPhee.
Thank you. Thank you.
Very well. Members, the next bill is the Public Safety, Department of Public Safety Policy Bill. The chair moves House File 3957. The motion would be to send this to Judiciary Committee. However, I will be moving to lay this over. There are amendments that are coming here that would arguably require the bill to go to Judiciary. However, those very same language will be up in Judiciary later today for consideration and discussion in a related bill. And so as opposed to sending the entire policy bill out to Judiciary and then have it come back here, when they're going to have the very same conversation and cover this issue. That seems like ineffective use of our time, and so I will be laying this over, but I am acknowledging for the members and for the public that there are provisions here that require judiciary committee review, and that those will in fact be reviewed in committee in the form of another bill. If that's not the case, you know, it certainly would be appropriate to move this language over, but I'm confident that that will be happening. So I just want everyone to know what the motion is before us. And then on top of that, members, it is, of course, custom and usage for us to take up bills as the author wishes it to be before the committee. And so we typically would have DE amendments, author's amendments done. There is a DE amendment filed. However, it is this chair's intent to be as and there's nothing that transparent about a DE, but there are several moving pieces, and so I opted to have that before us, but actually to break out in addition to that the DE language into distinct pieces, which then are carried in the form of individual amendments, so that all committee members are aware of those distinct pieces. There's no wrong way to do this. I mean, we're all required, as members to, familiarize ourselves with even big DE1s amendments. However, I just thought to facilitate this conversation, and it would be good to break that up and then therefore act on those distinct pieces. Those will be in the form of the A1, A2, and A3 amendments. Later on, there'll be a couple of other amendments, including one from the minority party and another one from the author. So what I'd like to do is ask the Department of Public Safety to come forward and talk to us about the A1, A2, A3 amendments. I'll then pause, and then we'll take action on those in terms of shaping the bill up the way the author wishes it to be, and then we'll have a full run of the bill, and then act on the other two amendments before us. So with that, I'm not sure who's kicking off from the department, so I'll look for my cue from the department who to call forward.
Good afternoon, Chair Mariani. John Harrington, for the record, Commissioner of the Department of Public Safety. Welcome. And I've asked Jordan Hosoptahai to do the honors of going through an explanation of the amendments.
Very well. Mr. Leff, oh, man.
Yeah. It's just Jordan. I probably butchered it too, because I usually screw it up every time I try and say it. So
I got it right once.
Yeah, you got more than I have then. So
how tough they had.
Very good.
Welcome. Good to see you again. Please give us your name for the record and begin your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Jordan Haltofterhide, and I am the legislative coordinator for the Department of Public Safety. I'm happy to walk through the amendments. So the A1 amendment is deleting Section 1 of the bill, and that's to maintain, to ensure that the Department of Homeland Security and Emergency Management within DPS has the ability to quickly respond with emergency teams that are needed when a state or federal emergency is declared. So that was a revision that the department would like. The A2 amendment brings in language that's found in House File 3772, which updates the BCA advisory group to expand that, and then also expands the criminal justice data network to make sure we can meet business needs. And BCA Superintendent Drew Evans will be on to discuss that more later in the hearing. The A3 amendment is body camera release footage language, but it's a little more than the department was seeking. So, Mr. Chair, I will also note that the A5 amendment, which maybe you were looking for later, is the department's version of the body camera release footage that we would be looking to introduce.
Very well. Why don't we take those one at a time? There's a little bit of complexity with the A3 amendment, and I'm going to be checking with staff to make sure we're technically doing this correctly. Let me turn to our lead member, minority member here. Lee Johnson, it'd be my intent that we act on the A1, the A2, and the A3 amendments as de facto authors amendments. And again, you know, I would have done this all in the DE amendment, but, you know, given the disparate, different provisions here, I thought it'd be clear if we, if a little bit more involved, nonetheless clear if we acted on these one by one as, author's amendments. Are you okay with us proceeding that way? We can certainly do a roll call vote on each one of them. But my hope is that we can just do voice votes on them.
Voice vote is fine on each one.
Very well. And Lee Johnson, I'll take these one at a time just to be really clear. The chair then moves the A1 amendment. All in favor of that motion, please say aye.
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 Opposed, same sign. Motion prevails, and the amendment is adopted. The chair then moves the A2 amendment. All in favor of that motion, please say aye.
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 Opposed, same sign. Motion prevails, and the A2 amendment is adopted. Mr. Havaptehide, I'm getting closer, man. Justin, my understanding is that the A3 amendment is needed to be moved in order to make the A5 amendment playable. And that just has to do with the timing of the amendments and how those came in. So I know we'll be, the author will be doing a change to the A3 amendment, but in order to do that, I've got to have the A3 amendment officially before us as an author's amendment. Lee Johnson, I just want to make sure that's clear and that's okay with you in terms of just moving for now with a voice vote on the A3.
That would be fine.
Very well. All in favor of the A3 amendment, please say aye.
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 Opposed, same sign. The motion prevails and the A3 amendment is adopted.
Mr. Chair, this is Jeff Diebel from House Research.
Oh, good. Thank you, Mr. Diebel.
I think you wanted to move the A3 amendment and then amend it.
Yes.
You didn't want to adopt it. So you adopted it unamended. So I think you want to reconsider that vote.
It was an amendment to the amendment. That's correct. Yes.
Yeah, so you want to reconsider that vote on the A3 and then bring it before the committee and then amend it.
Well, I was looking so sharp until then. Dog got it. I had that. All right. The chair moves to reconsider the A3 amendment. All in favor of reconsideration, please say aye.
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 Opposed, same sign. Motion prevails, and the A3 amendment is back before us. The chair now moves the A5 amendment to the A3 amendment. And now I will call on you, Mr. Havaptehide, to tell us what we're doing here.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And yes, Jordan, I'll talk about it with DPS. So this is the body camera release footage that DPS would like to put forward. The commissioner will certainly talk more about it later, but it makes standard, I believe, what is BCA practices or policy and moves that forward for the state.
Very well. Okay. Lee Johnson, we're okay with a voice vote on this? You might be muted.
Yes, that's fine.
Okay, very well. All in favor of the A5 amendment to the A3 amendment, signify by saying aye.
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 All same sign. Motion prevails, and the A3 amendment is amended. All in favor of the A3 amendment, please say aye. As amended.
Aye.
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 Opposed, same sign. Motion prevails, and the A3 amendment, as amended, is adopted. Okay. We'll hold on. I think we have one more amendment coming, but we'll hold off on that for a bit, and then we'll turn back to the department to walk us through the bill as amended. I don't know if you're muted or if.
Are you looking for the agency to start, Mr. Chair?
I am, yes.
Commissioner?
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. Once again, for the record, John Harrington, Commissioner of the Department of Public Safety. I apologize. I wasn't sure who you wanted to tee this up, and I have two items in particular, and then we have some other testifiers who are also with us today who can help explicate some of this. The first item is on the grant acceptance part of our bill. And this part of the bill would bring DPS into alignment with other state agencies in allowing us to accept donations, grants, and other gifts for the purpose of carrying out our duties and responsibilities, in particular of the commissioner under Section 299A, which is our enacting statute. As you recall, when I first got to this agency, the Attorney General and I embarked on the Deadly Force Encounters Working Group. This was a new concept. There had not been any funding or appropriation for that research. The Department of Public Safety does not have its own research and development arm. And as a consequence, we embarked on that without any ability to pay for expert witnesses to host convocations and other meetings. And we were fortunate enough that the community was so very supportive of this that many of the philanthropic agencies, seeing the need for this kind of research, offered to give us grants to help support our efforts until we could eventually get funding for that. Unfortunately, as we proceeded down that line, what we discovered was that the department was not allowed to accept donations or grants, unlike other state agencies. And so we had to find ways to take it out of other pots of funding and to do it more on a much tighter budget than I think we would have liked to. Currently, DPS can only accept grants from the federal government. Under this proposal, all money received would be deposited into a special revenue account in the state treasury. It would only be available to be spent for the purposes for which the funds were received, so that grant agreements, bequests, or other documents that would control what we can spend the money on. So this is not a pot of money that the commissioner can just dip into. This would be dedicated funding that, say, a philanthropic organization or another agency could say, we would like you to look at the opioid crisis. We could then use the money in that special revenue account to be able to do that work or to do other work that they would like us to do. We believe that adding this authority to the Department of Public Safety will allow us to be more responsive to Minnesotans' requests for us to be doing not just good work, but really state-of-the-art work. Things change rapidly in public safety, whether it is the different kinds of drugs that we're seeing on the streets, with the fentanyl being kind of our most recent piece, or changes in crime patterns, the rise of carjackings. We really do believe that the Department of Public Safety needs to have the opportunity to use grant dollars to be able to make sure that we're moving public policy in the proper direction, and this will, in fact, enable us to do that. The second piece that we want to offer is a piece in Section 6, which is report optimization is how we're describing it. And this bill would allow the legislature to optimize the number, and there is a significant number of reports that the Department of Public Safety is producing. By last count by staff, as an agency, DPS has 72 reports that are due in statute. If you think about, you know, the volume of reports that come through, and then there are 62 recurring reports, and it seems as if every year at the end of the legislative session, any new or novel approaches oftentimes require an additional report. So, for example, last session, there were 12 new reports added to that list. We're always willing to report on what the legislature is requesting. So this is not a concern there at all. And we rarely ask for resources to produce the additional reports, even though, once again, as we said, we don't have an R&D department, we don't have a statistical department in many of the areas that you ask for reports. And it means I'm taking staff folks who would be working with victims or working on crime problems off of that job to be able to produce the documents so that we can get the reports done in a timely fashion. So the goal of this proposal is to ensure that DPS is providing information that is both useful to the legislature and not wasting staff time producing reports that you no longer see as necessary. We all probably have a library full of binders of reports that get sent to us on a regular basis. And the question I often ask is, how many of those reports have ever really been read and seen the light of day? So, for example, reports that could be eliminated, we have multiple MNLARS reports on status updates and yearly data security audits on a system, frankly, that no longer exists. We're in MnDrive now, but the statutory requirement, and I recognize that this is public safety and not transportation, but the statutory requirement to produce these reports didn't go away even when the system did. And so the reports are brief, but they are still necessary, and someone has to take the time out of DVS to put those together. We have multiple biennial status reports that are now included in part of our biennial budget information. And another example would be our undercover buy fund, the Witness and Victim Protection Fund. That is a report that we believe could be eliminated because it is represented in other places. So this process would allow the legislature to take the lead to update reports and to request more relevant information as they need it. We're not asking to have less work, although we're asking to make sure the work we're doing is, in fact, the work that you want and need to have us do. Creating this process will allow the legislature to be in more full control of the reports that DPS produces. And just as a point of reference, in the last session, the legislature did pass a very similar piece of legislation for the Department of Human Services. So this doesn't require or expand or change our mission, but it does expand. It does expand, I think, your authority to make to pick and choose what it is you really do want to see. And I hope that will ultimately reduce staff time on reports that you don't really use.
Very well.
I would be happy to answer any questions on that or move on to the next topic with other speakers.
Yeah, why don't we do that? I don't want to break the, if you will, the rhythm of the department and make sure they get its provisions out, and then we'll circle back. I'm sure there'll be a number of questions. I have a few myself, but thank you for that, Commissioner. What I have on your list is that our BCA superintendent would go next.
That is correct, sir.
Very well. Let me call on Mr. Drew Evans. Superintendent Evans.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and others. Mr. Chair, would you like to speak to the question identity provision to begin with?
I'm sorry, say that again.
Would you like me to speak to the question identity portion of this to begin with rather than
the
minute?
Yes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Thank you for having us in front of the committee. One of the things that we've been continually tasked with examining is question identity in individuals. When an individual identity comes into question in certain situations, it can occur when a person either knowingly or unknowingly uses a person's name and date of birth in a criminal justice transaction. For the committee, one of the things that's important for everybody to know and understand, when an individual is arrested by law enforcement and booked in to one of our jail facilities across the state, that person is really known by their fingerprints. That's how we identify people. That's how we create an identification for that individual. And that's what travels with that individual through their criminal history process. the name that they use when they're booked, if it is not their proper name, still gets attached to that file, perhaps as an alias in that process, or if they use the wrong name to begin with, it might be on that file for some time period. What can happen, though, is when an innocent person's name is used by somebody that then uses that as an alias or gets warrants or other things that come across that process, it can create challenges for that person's, the innocent individual whose name is used on a regular basis. So what we've done is try to move forward with a proposal here to codify in statute some of the processes that we would put in place to try to improve the situation, to alleviate that burden on certain Minnesotans that they may experience through this process. The alias on the record of an individual who comes in contact with a regular basis with law enforcement is important, but it's also important to look for ways to improve outcomes for that individual who's an innocent person. What this file proposal would be a number of statutory changes to aid us in that question identity process, which is the process that we have in place when individuals come to the BCA and they provide their fingerprints to show they are not the individual or the alias that's on a particular record. And then we give them documentation to prove that they are a person with a question identity. In other words, an identity that somebody uses. Now, again, this can happen also in situations where we have people with very similar names, regardless of what it is. If it's, you know, Anderson's a very common name in our state, you may have a person with a similar name that pops up on warrant processes, for example. And so what we are doing in this is we would propose putting in statute that we would attach the image of an offender with our new criminal history system. We have the ability finally to do that. So we have a photograph that we would add to provide some ability for law enforcement in the field to see warrants in that picture. We would put the question identity name in the header of the warrant entry, trying to alert law enforcement that there's a question identity. We have an outline of our process. And then for the first time right now, we would authorize agencies to remove aliases when they prove that a false name has been provided, and then removal in certain situations over a certain period of time. And the statute outlines that we would have some criteria that we would consider to put in place through that process. It wouldn't happen in every situation, but it would give us the ability to do that, which currently we do not do. And then again, we would provide individuals who meet the question identity criteria with documentation to provide information on that if they encounter law enforcement along the way. So again, the goal, Mr. Chair and members, is to really put in statute a process to aid us in working on what is really a very complicated situation for us to work through, but to look for various ways to improve this process for Minnesotans.
All right, very well. And then Superintendent Evans, there are some other provisions as well. I'm not sure if you're the one to talk to that. I note the body cam issue that we referenced earlier. And then there's, I think there's a definition of computer theft crime. I'm not sure if those are in your
or not. I can start in a different order, and then I'll kick to the commissioner on the body cam issue, Mr. Chair. The first one with the computer theft crime, one of the things that we have encountered in some of our work that we do in the cyber arena is that we've encountered situations. The example we use is when an individual intruded into a database for a school district and downloaded the private information and credit card information of a number of different people stored within their system that they use to buy lunches for students, for example. The individual had downloaded an entire copy of that file. They had a copy of that file, but they did not publish it. And under our current statutes, that is not a crime. And so that individual, even though they had that, could sit on that information until they use it in another nefarious purpose. Even though they illegally accessed that system, we could not charge them with the computer theft under our state statutes. And so this would be modifying that statute so that somebody that goes in, that we show that it is a crime to go in and obtain databases such as that information. We want to make it clear that that would be illegal in and of itself, obtaining that information improperly through those intrusions. The second piece that I will speak to, Mr. Chair, and this is actually two parts, and it's in the A2 amendment that you adopted, and it's actually two parts. They're separate from each other. They were included here and when we originally introduced the bill, but they are separate pieces. They were included here because of a similar nature to what we do. The first one would be amending 299C.46, subdivision 1, and it's one line change, but it would authorize the Bureau of Criminal Apprehension may approve additional criminal justice uses by authorized agencies to access necessary system or services not from them or through the Bureau. The BCA operates a criminal justice data network. This is a secure data network of which our criminal justice data transfers and travels amongst law enforcement agencies in a secure manner across the state to protect that data. The statute was amended a few years ago and had an unforeseen consequence to us as we have different business needs, and I'll give a specific one that I know is of interest here, committee, that it does not allow the transfer of and use of this system to transfer video data. So, for example, as agencies implement body camera footage, for example, it makes sense for them to secure that data across our criminal justice network and upload it in that fashion. Under this current statute, they would have to do that in a different network and not utilize the CJ. We refer to it as the CJDN. We think it makes sense for that example to utilize the CJDN data transfers that are related to criminal investigations. And right now, as written, it would only allow them to access services from the BCA. We can do this without a cost to the BCA and can be operated within the current environment. And so that would be the first change to allow for additional uses that we would authorize. They still would have to adhere with all other policies, practices, and procedures and the security that is necessary to be on that network today. And then the second piece that we are proposing is the BCA currently provides assistance to the criminal justice information and advisory group that consists of a number of members from the Commissioner of Corrections, Commissioner or their designee, public safety, members of the judicial branch, members of the legislature, the County Attorneys, et cetera, Association, et cetera, a large swath of criminal justice stakeholders. They have focused historically on criminal justice sharing information topics, but one of the things that we've been looking to as we appear in front of your committee and others is, are there other ways to have a group of interested stakeholders from the outside that we interact with on a regular basis to provide us input, advice on BCA operations as we implement new policies. For example, when you pass legislation on the UAV policy, this would be a great group from our perspective to vet our UAV policy prior to posting it for input, for example. Same thing when it comes to various audits or reviews that we do internally. I can read those and I read them on a regular basis and we implement internally, but we'd also like an outside perspective for individuals that are designated to this group to provide us input and advice. Same thing when it comes to our privacy policy and other operations that guide us. This is what we believe is a good accountability mechanism for our operations to build further trust and transparency and accountability in the work that we do across the BCA. And also we've been looking for an arena to do some of the same things with the forensic science community, as some of our forensic science has become complicated in many different ways. And this group would do this. We presented this proposal to that group. They're willing to take on this additional duties and don't need additional staff time or anything, that we can absorb this internally to provide this additional work by this group. And I will conclude there, Mr. Chair, and I'll take it to the commissioner to the body cams before we answer questions.
Very well. Thank you, Superintendent. Commissioner.
Mr. Chair, thank you very much. In regard to the body cam amendment, the Department of Public Safety has put forward a body cam or a footage release recommendation that would make create a standard that when the footage can be released, that would, we think, is really the a vehicle that should be seriously considered. Putting this language into statute will establish consistency both for the family and for legal representatives of the family, no matter what jurisdiction is involved in an incident, which we think provides you the level of consistency statewide that that we have heard you and your members and others in the community ask for. proposal provides for families to see the footage no later than 5 business days following an incident of deadly force used by a peace officer. So within 5 days after that, the chief law enforcement officer would release the video to the family, either the parents of a child or the immediate parent or their representative, assuming that there is no conflict in the ongoing criminal investigation. And so there could be situations where a chief would need to say the family members were involved in this criminal investigation in a different way and therefore could not be allowed to see the video. But they would need to explain that and provide notice to the family about that within a timely fashion. In addition to that, the footage would then be released to the public no later than 14 days after the incident. So 14 business days in particular, I do want to make that note. And once again, this would be the standard statewide unless the investigating agency or the CLIO, whose video it is, ultimately the CLIO is the owner of the video and the investigative agency, which is the BCA's use of force unit, is the recipient of the investigative data, but the video originates with the local agency. Unless the investigative agency or the CLIO believes that allowing the family or the public to view the would interfere with the ongoing investigation. And once again, in this case, it would still require us to give notice. So there would have to be an explanation for this. And there's also an additional remedy, which if the family wishes to pursue it, they could then go to district court to pursue that release in a more timely fashion. They would then have to, there would be the argument, obviously, at that point of whether or not the compelling interest of the ongoing criminal investigation or the compelling interest of the family should hold sway. But that would then be taken up not by local law enforcement or by the investigative agency. That would be taken up by an outside group.
All right, very well. Thank you, Commissioner. I just want to keep us moving. We'll come back for questions. I believe next is Director Kate Weeks.
Good afternoon, Chair members. Thank you so much for having me today. OJP has two smaller pieces in the public safety policy bill. The first one is basically cleanup language. As many of you know, OJP was cobbled together in 2003 with duties brought from multiple different agencies under one umbrella. One of those are creating designations for domestic abuse shelters. Originally, that work was done from in the Department of Corrections. And when that moved over, statutory language was not adjusted to show that OJP under the Department of Public Safety now has those responsibilities. I did reach out to the Department of Corrections prior to putting this language forward, and they are supportive. The next piece is actually cleanup language from last year when we, when the legislature passed, thank you for allowing us to clarify the victim notification statutes. There was a provision under the civil commitment notification piece that made notification automatic. The intent of the language was supposed to be that victims could opt in to being notified. So we would just like to reestablish that original intent.
All right. Pretty straightforward. Thank you. And then next we have the State Fire Marshal, Mr. Smith. Come forward, please, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Jim Smith, and I am State Fire Marshal. We have two sections within this bill. Section 7 is specific to our hazardous material response teams. We are the State Fire Marshal Division, which oversees the state teams, is moving toward a model that mirrors the federal model where we are typing our teams, type 1 being the most robust in equipment personnel, type 4 being much smaller than that. Therefore, we would like to change the language simply to hazardous material response teams, which would still address each and every team. However, it makes it more generic. Thereby, we can classify the teams type 1 through type 4. We've also requested removal of the term regional hazardous material response team. Again, just making it hazardous material response team. The second section is down in section 11. And that has to do with smoke detector versus smoke alarm. There is a difference between a smoke detector and a smoke alarm. A smoke detector is a device that detects smoke but does not necessarily enunciate an alarm, where a smoke alarm is exactly what it says. It smells smoke and alarms the occupants. And in order to be in line with our Minnesota State Fire Code, we would like to change all definitions, smoke detector, or all references of smoke detector, change that over to smoke alarm. Thank you.
Thank you, Chief Smith. I appreciate it. All right, members, I think that then covers the department's walkthrough of its of the major provisions. I have a couple of questions. I also want to make sure that we get to the amendment. I also have a member who has a question, but I don't want to forget this amendment, which I can easily do on a day like today. But just very quickly, the commissioner, on the issue of the grants, it does, I am informed that by staff that right now an agency could accept grants, any agency, but it's got to go through MMD that would have the oversight. That still doesn't, you know, take care, I think, of the issues that, that the department is concerned with and wants to focus on. Certainly there are departments that are able to not have to go through a MMB and be able to receive grants directly, but usually those are targeted for very specific programs, and you know, there's an element of awareness on the part of the legislature relative to, you know, what those programs are. So that, you know, this body then, you know, is fully informed in terms of what resources are going into, you know, the agencies it has oversight of. So all that by way of saying, and we're not going to be moving this bill today, but really more all that by way of saying, you know, inviting your openness in terms of perhaps tightening up, if we're going to move forward with this, perhaps tightening up this language, you know, with some more, you know, specificity, if you will, you know, similar to other instances where, you know, departments, you know, have sought, you know, legislative, you know, involvement and awareness. I don't want to get into a super long conversation, but and I can only speak for myself. I would be, you know, concerned about real broad language. You know, given some of the history in our nation, this is not pointing to your department per se, but just our history of our nation in terms of the kind of resources that have come in. Including a lot of criticism from citizens about military grade style, you know, donations to sectors of our local public safety sector. I also want to talk through a little bit more carefully about, we certainly saw, you know, this example of this proposal at the local level over in Minneapolis earlier this year, where communities were offering to pay for public, you know, direct public safety services. And so I want to at least be transparent about, you know, the possibility of something like that, you know, being, you know, promulgated through you know, state acceptance of funds. So it seems to me that therefore the need for, you know, less broad and much more targeted language might be, at least for me, it would be of comfort and could well be for other members as well. So I guess the question really to you, Commissioner, is just your willingness to engage in that conversation and perhaps reshaping since we're not moving this bill today.
And Chair Mariani and members of the committee, we're open to having that conversation. I will tell you that as we've looked at this over the last couple of years, this was the recommendation of MMB that we should get this level of authority. Okay. So we are working through the process of oversight, but I certainly understand your concerns that we're not going to engage in any kind of a pay for police action. That would be, in my mind, ethically inappropriate and not fit within the way the department is codified in statute. And to the extent that we can come up with language that would give you greater comfort in that, I am happy to have that conversation.
Terrific. Thank you, Commissioner. We'll follow up with you on that. And I do see your hand, Representative Lucero, but before we do that, I do want to make sure I'm honoring the amendment that's on the table still from your side of the aisle. This goes to the issue of the mandated reports, request. And so at this point, let me just pause to see if anyone wishes to offer that amendment at this point.
Mr. Chair, I'd like to move the A4 amendment, please. Very this is well. Representative Mueller.
Very well, thank you. Representative Mueller moves adoption of the A4 amendment. Representative Mueller, to your amendment.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. And this is this amendment would just go straight to talking about the Section 6 of the expiration of the mandated reporting mandates. We heard the commissioner talk about how this is, you know, expanded role of the legislature, but if you look at the actual language that's in there, it is not. And so it is important. There's a reason why we ask our agencies to report on what is happening and to make sure that not only are agencies held accountable, but so that we can also reassess if a program is meeting goals and if they are still needed. I hear what the commissioner is saying, like how he said that, we still have to give a report about MNLARS and that doesn't even exist anymore. If that's something that should be eliminated, then this is something that should be started by the legislature. And we would, I'm sure, I don't want to speak for other members, but I'm sure that if we received a list from the commissioner of reports that no longer are necessary, then we would love to take a look at that and take his recommendation into account. However, this should be stemmed from the legislature, and we should be able to continue to get these reports so that we can take appropriate action when necessary. So my amendment is very simple. It would just say that we're just replacing the language that says that these reports do not expire and that they continue to give the reports as put in statute. And that if the legislature does not repeal or modify any report, that they continue. But if they want us to repeal or modify any of those, they need that needs to start from the legislature. So members, I urge a green vote. Thank you.
Very well. Commissioner?
Chairman Yanni, Representative Mueller, thank you very much. I appreciate that. And I think we're not that far apart on this, because what we really want is an optimization of the reports. We really do want the legislature to make a decision about, you know, if you don't want a MNLARS report to hit your desk because the system doesn't exist anymore, please tell us, because it in the absence of being directed, we're going to continue to approve the report, because that's what statutory language does. Our read of the A4 amendment creates another report, though, rather than eliminating them. So while it's a great intermediary step, we see it as a step that frankly is already done by the legislative reference library that already has created that database of required reports for the state agency. But we will happily have further conversation about it. What we really do want, though, is to try and optimize what we're producing so that it meets what you need. That really is what the heart of our language is. And to the extent that we can do that, whether it's by creating a list of reports we think should sunset, or you're doing that via the legislative library, we are open to that conversation.
Very well. Lee Johnson, I believe, to this point.
Chair Mariani, Representative Harrington. Sorry about that. Commissioner Harrington.
That's okay.
I actually like this amendment for the simple reason with the current language in the bill, there's a requirement for a new group, which is the looking at the security of our prisons, and it's a report to the legislature. The first report is due this year, but they're just getting started. The next report isn't due till 2024, and this language would end that report. And that report is designed to give us information so we know best how to deal with the next budget year, the issues that are in our prisons. I think it'd be much better if you would provide every year or every other year a list of reports that you don't believe are needed anymore, and we can go through and remove them. Yes, it's one more report, but like you said, MNLARS doesn't exist. If you would have gave when MNLARS is phased out, informed the Transportation Committee about that report, they could have removed it at that time when they swapped off the MNLARS. So I think it's more advantageous for you to go through the reports, let us know where the information is, if we want that, and let the legislature decide which reports we need. I actually read all the reports I get. Sometimes there's good information, sometimes it's basic information. But it is good information that this legislature needs to make critical decisions on how the operation of public safety should be. So I would speak in favor of this amendment.
Well, Lee Johnson, I tend to agree with you and Representative Mueller. However, I don't hear, I think, a disagreement about the purpose and the function of the commission's request here, which is, I think the commission articulated pretty well, which is. Over time, there's been an accumulation of reports here that, we think might be questionable. And before, we continue down this road of putting a lot of energy into those, let's consider not doing that. What I'm hearing you, Representative Mueller, say is that the legislature should play an affirmative role relative to each of these reports, and so I think that's consistent with what I believe the department is searching for. Commissioner, and then we'll move to act on the amendment. If there's anything else you want to add. Yeah.
Mr. Chair, you are absolutely correct. We're trying to find a vehicle for reducing unnecessary reports, whether that is by us producing a list that we flag and we can call that question, and if that is helpful to reduce the reports, or whether they automatically sunset after a certain period of time. The mission here is to make sure that you get the information that you need and you want, and that we make sure that the staff at the Department of Public Safety are doing the work that is most necessary, since we have to prioritize the work. So we're not in opposition. We thought the sunset clause would expedite it, but we are certainly open to the form of the A4 amendment also, because I think it will accomplish the same ultimate end, which is to reduce unnecessary or outdated material from coming before you.
Very well. I would encourage members to support this, but I do want to I believe that's Representative Mueller. You get the last word here.
Thank you, Chair Mariani. I just wanted to say that while we do have the same goal, that what's really important is what is actually being written in the statute, and what is being written or what has been offered to us here does have an automatic sunset. What we're saying here is, you know, while we have the same goal, let's make sure that the statute doesn't take away the authority of the legislature. So thank you. I would also encourage agreement.
Very well. Representative Mueller renews her motion that the A4 amendment, is that the right number? Yes. The A4 amendment be adopted. The clerk will take the roll.
Voice is fine.
You're fine with a voice vote?
Yes.
Very well. All in favor of the A4 amendment, please say aye.
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 Opposed, same sign. Motion prevails, and the A4 amendment is adopted. Members, I'm going to call on Representative Lucero, then I'm going to move to make sure that we get Representative Hewat's bill in. We have the 911 program manager testifying, as well as a public testifier, so I'm going to push really assertively here. We're going to be laying this bill over, so we won't be voting. Representative Lucero.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I just had a question for Superintendent Evans. But before I get to my question, I just wanted to comment on something you had remarked on, Mr. Chair, as well, in regards to outside groups potentially funding or giving money or contributing to agencies of law enforcement. I agree with you. That's a huge concern. I just think public safety being the number one purpose of government, it is the sole, it's in my opinion, the sole responsibility of the legislature to appropriate the money to our public safety agencies and not to allow for the appearance of potential impropriety or influence. Yeah, we just want to maintain that public trust. I mean, in other areas as too, like elections and other things, but for public safety, we just don't want to have it. So that anyway, that's my piece on that. But the question for Superintendent Evans is, in regards to the computer theft or not computer theft, the computer crime, my first question is, and I'll try to be real brief here, Mr. Chair, I don't have a lot of questions, but the first question is there a scope by which these computers or computer systems are narrowed to, or such as government systems or employer-employee relationship type systems, or is it any computer system out there?
Superintendent.
So, you know, it would have to be done with the level of impropriety. Sorry, Mr. Chair and Representative Lucero. I think I understand your question. It would not be a situation where, if an individual or an employee is simply downloading from their employer with a system that they have access to. In other words, they have access to that system. This would be a situation under the statute, and the goal is to make it so that if somebody that does not have authorized access to that system goes in and downloads data from that, it doesn't have to be an employer, it could be a hacker of some sort, but it would be a system they are not authorized to access, they download something from, if that answers your question, Representative Lucero.
Representative Lucero.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It doesn't, but that was kind of related to my second question. My first question is, I'll try to articulate it better. Of all the computer systems out there, there are personal computer systems. Like, I'm talking to you through a state-owned computer system. I'm holding in my hand my personal computer system here. There are there's multiple types of computer systems out there. With the language in front of us, is this narrowed in scope to a certain segment of computer systems, such as government agency computer systems or school district computer systems, or is it any type of computer system out there?
Mr. Chair, Representative Lucero, would not be limited to government systems. So private employers, others, it would be open to them as well.
Representative Lucero.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chair. And so then I would just submit for consideration, as this language is being refined, there are multiple scenarios where I think there may be unintended consequences, such as let's say there's a shared computer within somebody's house, and they go through it, and because of the definition here, data can mean information in digital form. So that's an Excel spreadsheet, that's a Word document, that's an Excel, or I mean, sorry, a WAV file, that's a picture. And then if they access or copy that. So that can be anything. So I could be sharing a computer with my 19-year-old son. Let's say we have a shared laptop in the house. Could I be accused now of unauthorized access to a piece of information that's his property? Or how about another scenario where my wife comes to my mobile phone, accesses it, takes a picture and texts it to herself or another, right? So I just think there's some unintended consequences here. So maybe just adding suggestion would be malicious or criminal intent or something like that to make it a little bit more strong in terms of the action. So thank you.
Very well. Thank you, Representative Lucero. Superintendent Evans, you're open this to consider, some bumper guard language like that?
Mr. Chair, Representative Lucero, certainly always open to working on language to, address any concerns. I mean, from our perspective in terms of proving criminal intent, I hear you loud and clear. I think the language as written intentionally and without authorization accesses or copies, the goal would be obviously that there would be some level of malicious intent that would be associated with that. Same thing with intentionally retains beyond the individual's authority. So in other words, in the examples that you utilized, if it's a wife and husband, I think it would be difficult to prove that beyond, a reasonable doubt criminally, but certainly if there's ways to work on this language that would provide further, assurances that it's not being used improperly. It truly is to address situations that have arisen in our investigations where an individual was acting with malicious purpose, but we couldn't hold them accountable simply because of the statutes. Certainly willing to work on that.
Right. Members, I am going to push forward. I apologize to you, Chair Pinto, but I want to make sure we hear Representative Hewitt. This issue is coming back. We're going to lay this over, and it sounds like there may be some work that will happen with the return of superintendents and our members here. That's how we create better laws than what we initially come up with. So, all right, with that, thank you, Commissioner and Superintendent, Director, State Fire Marshal, and thank you, Mr. Hulhofterheide. It only took me 10 times. With that, the chair lays over House File 3955. Oh, no. Lays over, what's my number here?
3957.
Thank you. House File 3957 as amended. With that, Representative Hewitt moves House File 3956 to be referred to the Judiciary Committee. Members, we are going to be laying this over for possible inclusion, so we won't be voting on a motion to that, but that is the motion to get the bill before us with the understanding we're going to be laying this over. Representative Hewitt, House File 3956.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I'll avoid my 5 pages of testimony here that I have. I'm totally intrigued by our 911 system. Even though I've worked in the system for years, I cannot tell you what it takes when you call 911 to get it to your local police department within seconds. It's amazing, but yes. We'll save that discussion for another day. First thing I want people to know is I appreciate the chair's willingness to lay this over. There is some work that needs to be done. The department is willing to do that work so we can bring it back up so we can move this bill along. Also understand that this recommendation that for the bill is not the only coming out of that task force. There are several items coming up out of that. This one just has to be sent on its merry way because there's a lot of things that need to be done. And they need to get going or else we're going to lose some federal funding. So saying that, what this simply does is, if you all remember, and I know our police officers that are on this committee remember, and I bet you many of you do, is remember when we went to enhance 911, and that was when they figured out that they had to get all our locations so they could send the ambulance or send someone for help. That was the first generation. This is Gen 2 here. They're going to get more technical with us and be able to do 911 calls by text and things like that we got to get up to date here. So I'm not going to go down my list of stuff. I'm going to let the experts talk real quick here on it. I'm going to turn it right over to our department here, Chair Mariani, if we could do that.
Absolutely. We have Sandy Stroud, I believe, from Department of Public Safety.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of this committee. My name is Sandy Stroud. I am the 911 Program Manager for DPS's Emergency Communication Networks Division. Thank you for the opportunity to testify on House File 3956 today. I first want to thank Representative Hewitt for authoring this bill, and second, the members of Minnesota's Statewide Emergency Communications Board who aided us in the development of these recommended updates. ECN carries the responsibility of playing a critical role in that delivery of 911 calls to our state's public safety answering points, or PSAPs, as I'll say going forward. Minnesota has made some investments in updating its 911 network infrastructure, but now must make the next step to implement a next generation 911 network, or NG911. The current 911 system configuration relies on some legacy or E911 components blended with next-gen 911 technologies. But part of the impetus for this statutory update is to enable fully moving to an NG911 network. Making the complete update to NG911 will enable ECN to ensure that when someone in Minnesota calls 911 from any type of supported device, our network will be able to deliver that call. The updates in this bill represents how the network operations are currently managed while keeping intact the independent roles and responsibilities of each individual PSAP. These changes are necessary so that ECN can statutorily operate in the role it has played for several years, while also enabling it to meet the demands of technology updates necessary to reach full next-gen 911 network capabilities. ECN worked very closely with the SECB on developing these proposed updates to the statute, which came with full support from each regional emergency communication or services board in Minnesota. We have learned in the past day that some of our partners outside of the SECB have concerns with these proposed updates. ECN does look forward to having the opportunity to work with all of our partners on more agreeable language. This bill is vitally important to the future of 911 systems in the state of Minnesota. Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I will stand for questions.
Thank you, Ms. Stroud. Next, we have Representative Hewitt. I see a public testifier, Brent Christensen of the Minnesota Telecommunications Alliance. If you can come forward, state your name for the record and give us your testimony, we'd appreciate it.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Brent Christensen, and I'm the president and CEO of the Minnesota Telecom Alliance. We're a trade association that represents 41 telephone companies, primarily family-owned and co-ops and commercial companies throughout Minnesota. I appreciate the opportunity to testify today in opposition of House File 3956. MTA members are the ones that deploy the networks that make 911 possible. We connect our customers to the 911 networks and interconnect PSAPs throughout the state. And this bill, as written right now, completely undermines current law that's responsible for the well-functioning 911 system since its inception in 1977. Throughout the history of the 911 system, there has been a need to update and amend the law and the 911 system. These changes have always been accomplished with little controversy, with a collaborative process. And right now, this bill is an end run around that collaborative process, and there's been no consultation or input from the MTA or our members. We understand that technology changes, and more than most, I would suspect, and we agree that the statute needs to be changed. However, this is a drastic bill that undermines the fabric of the original intent of the 911 law. We collect 911 fees from our customers, and a portion of that fee is intended to, from the beginning, to allow us to recover our costs to provide that service. And this bill eliminates the duty of the state to pay providers for the required network costs. This bill also eliminates liability protection that protects the industry from lawsuits. It now makes providers susceptible to litigation for call elements that are outside of our control. It requires a provider to provide a copy of the subscriber database at no cost, including address and location to DPS. and this can sometimes require substantial IT costs, which are currently able to be reimbursed from this work. This bill requires telecom providers to connect calls at points of interconnection provided by the state. Costs for the connectivity and delivery of 911 calls, including caller identification data, to points of interconnection with the responsibility of the telco. Mr. Chairman, members, as it written, House File 3956 is a poorly conceived bill that actually could do more harm to the 911 network than it would help. I appreciate Representative Hewitt for reaching out to me today, and I look forward to working with him and the other stakeholders on this issue. Thank you for the opportunity to appear before you today, and with that, I'm happy to stand for questions.
Thank you for your testimony, sir. With that, I don't see any other testifiers. Representative Hewitt, we can open this up for some discussion, including from you. So let's do that right now.
Mr. Chair, and I think that you heard clearly that there is not peace in the world here, and we're going to have to make sure that we work this out before I bring it back to the members for a vote, and I think we're close. I did talk to the department, and I did talk to the stakeholders, and we'll get them in the same room before I bring it back here for a vote. If we just had this scheduled. I thought we had peace, but we don't, and so I appreciate you laying it over. In fact, I think we can fix it so it doesn't even have to go to judiciary anymore. So that's what I'm hearing right now.
Yeah, that's right. I think there's some liability language, is my understanding, in the bill that would necessitate it moving to judiciary if the chair wanted that. But my understanding is that that might be addressed in a
right. And Mr. Chair, I did talk to the chair of judiciary, and she would be more than happy not to hear the bill if it can be worked out. She's really busy. That's what she told me yesterday.
Indeed. Well, thank you for reaching out to all the stakeholders in true Representative Hewitt fashion. Lee Johnson.
Chair Mariani, members, Mr. Christensen, thank you for that information. We do our best to try to get the bills right before they leave the committee, and apparently we have a little bit more work to do on this bill. I'm hoping we can get it worked out, because I think it is important to update our laws to what the type of equipment we're actually using. Our 911 laws were written a long time ago, Chapter 403, and this is the third update. We've gone from regular 911 to the enhanced 911, and now we're at next gen. And we need to update our laws to follow them without any unintended consequences. So hopefully we can get it all worked out, but we also have some other issues that we need to deal with, dealing in the 911 telecommunicators. As somebody, even Representative Hewitt, received the information from our telecommunicators through our PSATs, and we know how important to get the proper information out to the people, on whether it's the ambulance crew, the law enforcement, the fire department. We need good, actual, proper information to get the right services where they need to be as soon as possible. I know Representative Igo has House File 3974 that is important for that information, and I'm hoping that we can hear that bill as well pretty soon, because I think that is an important situation that we need to deal with as well. So I know we're going to be laying this bill over, so I won't delay any longer. Our time is about up. And with that, I'll turn it back to Chair Mariani.
Thank you, Lee Johnson. Ms. Stroud, I see you nodding, so I thought maybe I'd just refer to you really quickly before we move forward.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Yeah, we're very open, and we are looking forward to being able to sit down with our telecommunication partners and work through these language issues and be able to come to some consensus. And I agree. I think that we're not that far off. Also, I would say, in regards to the telecommunicators, I did have the honor to be able to represent ECN on that working group, and we are very excited about being able to bring that forward as well. So that will be welcome to bring that in front of this committee too.
Very well. Thank you, Ms. John. Thank you for your efforts as a member of that working group. Representative Huat, the last few seconds are yours, and then we'll play this over.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I will take those last few seconds to one of the calls I got yesterday was from the telecommunicators, and they really are pushing forward, and there's no question that they are first responders. I would bet none of us that have worked in that street don't doubt that at all. They're the first level. So I know they're watching today and know that we're working on that. So thank you, Chair Mariotti, for hearing the bill. We'll be working on it and hopefully be back to the committee soon.
Sounds good. Thank you, Representative Huat. With that, the chair lays over House File. We didn't amend this. No, House File 3956. Members, that concludes our work for today. Thank you for the good, rigorous conversation and debate. And I look forward to the next time we're together, which will be on Thursday at 1 p.m. Until then, have a blessed day and a good day in between as well. This committee, until Thursday, this committee stands adjourned.